So I'm Rick Hansen. It's July 17th, 2013. And I wanted to pick up the thread from last week, which picked up the thread from the previous week. Last week's topic was Buddhist entitlement is not an oxymoron. And that followed the previous week, which was Buddhist assertiveness is not an oxymoron. And we're in the nitty-gritty trenches of practice when things are, you know, when the fur starts to fly, when we're irritated, when we feel let down, when people are coming at us, when things are challenging, when the deck is stacked against us, we're outnumbered. You know, the conditions are not right, really, for getting our own needs met. What do we do, right? And last week I talked about this very, for me at least, beautiful and powerful and profound image and perhaps even truth of the night of the Buddha's own awakening, when he was most beset by the forces coming at him of upset and anger and seduction and all of that. When he was coming at him, he touched the ground. He reached down and he touched the ground, claiming, in a sense, the all rightness of his being here and his own needs, and also drawing sustenance from the ground, being supported by underlying causes and conditions that supported his development, his happiness, his awakening. Tonight I'd like to talk about the ground in a less concrete way, and yet, I hope, a way that is meaningful and useful for you. And to enter into that, I'd like to start by pointing out a kind of paradox, which you're probably quite aware of. On the one hand, to really nourish ourselves, to bring compassion to ourselves and kindness to ourselves as we would to all beings, to stand up for ourselves, to take charge of our own unfolding, to take responsibility for it, to be a lamp unto ourselves as the Buddha counsels us to do that. In some ways, that kind of essentializes you. It makes you into a thing, a being, a one who is asserting her needs, his needs, my needs, right? And that corresponds to a kind of experience we have when we're being strong on our own behalf in situations. We feel relatively solid. In a sense, we need to kind of pull up a sense of strength or solidity or groundedness to be able to assert ourselves when it's time to do that. Yet on the other hand, as the Buddha teaches and we know, there's something fundamentally foamy and insubstantial about experience. There's something fluid, without boundaries, without solidity in our own experience, and we recognize that increasingly, that this quality, this is the nature, this foaminess, this emptiness as an adjective, is not just the nature of our own experience, sights, sounds, tastes, touches, feelings, and so forth, our phenomenology, but it's actually the nature of the hard stuff. Materiality, you know, coming and going, it's all empty, right? And so how do we reconcile these two truths? The truth of a certain solidity around asserting ourselves, right? And yet on the other hand, this opening out increasingly into emptiness, into a growing felt sense, you know, moments of awakening many times a day, as they say in Tibet, a second here, an instant there, you know, 4 seconds in a row in the afternoon, a good dozen seconds during the morning sit, gradually adding up more and more pearls, being, you know, coming onto the thread of the day, the moments of the day over time, you know, we have this growing sense of emptiness. So how do we hold those two together? You see the kind of question I'm raising? It can get conceptual, but if you go into your experience, you can just know what it's like. Here I am opening out into oneness. I kind of have a sense of that, right? Here I am being strong on my own behalf. They feel kind of different. How do we hold them together? How do we become increasingly transparent and foamy, in a sense, while also becoming stronger and stronger as a wellspring of love and compassion, including for ourselves? To explore this, and then we can talk more about it, I wanted to read and kind of read slowly and talk through a letter from Ajahn Suchito, who's an Englishman, who is a longtime Dharma practitioner and teacher, and he's the abbot of one of two Theravadin Vipassana monasteries in England. And he's a peer of Ajahn Sumedho, Ajahn Amaro, Ajahn Pasano, people like that, longtime practitioner. Personally, if you ever have a chance to do a retreat with monks and nuns, monastics, I recommend it. And I went on retreat, and it was a monastic retreat, and he was the primary teacher, along with Ajahn Metta, a woman who we co-taught with, which was quite unusual, at least as of a couple years ago, and wonderful to see. And he's the real deal, so I want to read you his letter and see what you think about it. So, he's writing here, and so I'll just start. Dear Inquiring Mind, and by the way, this comes from Inquiring Mind magazine, which is wonderful. It's freely offered. Comes out, I think, four times a year, produced in the Bay Area. Wes Nisker, who taught here just, I think, a few weeks ago, a month ago maybe, is the founding editor-in-chief of the magazine. His spirit infuses it. But I think it's great to support it, like I do, with money. Okay, here we go. So here's Ajahn Suchito. It says, Dear Inquiring Mind, having finally read the fall... I'm assuming someone's okay. Doesn't sound like distress. The wind, we probably need air. You know, so a goad to mindfulness, right? Better than chainsaws in Southeast Asian temples, right? You know, which routinely happen. Okay, so he says, having finally read the fall 2011 edition, I noticed that the Yeshe Tubten Yinpa interview found no word for empathy in Buddhism. I'd like to propose the word anukampa from the Pali canon as a candidate. Pali is the language of early Buddhism, P-A-L-I, Pali. Anukampa. Sometimes translated as compassion or sympathy, it means, quote, to tremble in the presence of, or in modern parlance, to resonate. It appears as the sense which filled the Buddha after his awakening as he turned toward the human world, depicted as the descent of the Brahma deity, father of all, who on bended knee requested the Buddha to teach out of anukampa, empathy. Okay? And the ground I'm talking about and getting into can include those sounds, right? And the people producing them, singing, whatever they're doing. Hopefully they're getting class credit. Maybe we can close that door as well, maybe those windows. Let's see how this works, okay? All right, so we're talking here about empathy, okay? In the brain, empathy is produced by multiple processes, some of which resonate with the actions of others. Those are the most ancient and fundamental ones. The mirror neurons, mirror-like networks, very primitive animals, particularly mammals certainly, have these networks. Other networks resonate with the emotions of others, tremble in sympathy with, to paraphrase anukampa. We resonate with, we co-vibrate, if you will, sympathetically, emotionally. And then other circuits, very recent ones, help us tune into the thoughts. The more sophisticated, complex, sometimes conceptual processes happening in other people and the dynamics of that. We tremble with, okay, that's what empathy is fundamentally. So here Ajahn Suchito is talking about the Buddha responding to the needs of others. He trembled with their needs and became motivated to spend the next 40 years of his life working pretty hard to share his realization and teach other people. Okay. Then Ajahn Suchito goes on. He says, we are naturally empathic, but ignorance and defilements cloud the picture. And it is through mindfulness of others that our hearts return to their proper balance. So he says, he points out that our ground is empathy. Okay? Our natural background, the wallpaper of the interpersonal field, is empathy. Right? We may not like the other person. We may not approve of the other person. We may need to protect ourselves from the other person in some ways. But the underlying ground, that's our natural state, is feeling with them, is a relatedness with them as our underlying ground. And then he quotes from the Pali Canon, the early teachings of the Buddha. This is the Buddha speaking here. And how does one look after others? By looking after oneself. By practicing, developing, and applying mindfulness frequently. And how does one look after oneself? By looking after others. By patience, by non-harming, by kindness, and by empathy. This word again, anukampa. In looking after oneself, one looks after others. And looking after others, one looks after oneself. Isn't that profound? That's just right there. One looks after oneself by practicing, developing, and applying mindfulness frequently. A second kind of ground that I'm going to talk about in a moment. And how does one look after oneself? By looking after others, by patience, by non-harming, by kindness, grounded in empathy. He says, this primal sympathy, anukampa, is the ground from which the Brahma-viharas, the heavenly abodes, the very elevated qualities of mind and heart, the Brahma-viharas of kindness, compassion, empathic joy, and equanimity arise. This primal sympathy, this resonance with others as the wallpaper, the underlying space or ocean of waves of interactivity with other people, that interpersonal field is the ground of kindness, compassion, altruistic joy, and equanimity, which are highly regarded certainly in Buddhism and obviously around the world. Which of these Brahma-viharas arises depends on the nature of what the empathy is turned toward. The lovable, that's kindness. The suffering, that's compassion in response. The admirable, that's sympathetic joy, altruistic joy, happiness at the good fortune or happiness at the development or attainments or goodness of other people. And then last, whether we are paying attention to the karmic predicament of another being, which is where equanimity comes in. Okay. It is this ground of empathy which is present prior to the formations of self. This ground of empathy which is present, it is this ground of empathy which is present prior to the formations of self that receives and responds. It's this background quality of relatedness, attunement, resonance that receives and responds, which is why an enlightened one can practice compassionate action without a self basis and without accruing karmic results. This is a heavy-duty letter. It's really, you're just kind of tracking what he's saying. That's, to me, one of the hallmarks of people really far along is they just kind of boom. Drop it. You know, it's just like that. So what is he saying? He's talking about a ground, a background of relatedness that's very native to our experience. It's literally biologically based through evolution and profoundly developed in the most social species on the planet of all human beings. Right? So the distinction here often is when we're with other people, so I want to kind of make it experiential and see what you think about this. Often with other people, we're aware of, to use the metaphor I offered in the suggestions for meditation practice tonight, we're aware of the flotsam and jetsam in the river of relatedness. We're aware of the words, we're aware of the positionality, the tone, we're aware of our reactions to those other people, we're aware of all kinds of content. In other words, we have thoughts about what they say, we have emotions about it, body sensations arise that capture our attention, we have desires that develop, we have reactions, we like this, we don't like that, right? We see them, we hear their voice, we replay the conversation. There's a lot of content, right, in that river of relatedness. And hopefully you'll forgive the visuals here, but I think sometimes of a river in flood with, alas, dead cows bloated and upside down with their hooves sticking up, and all kinds of crud flows through the river of relatedness, at least in my mind. I don't know about yours, at least some of the time. So, and yet, underneath the content, if we pull our attention back from the content, you know, or to kind of mix my metaphor here, if we pull it out of the figure and we move more to the ground, kind of the wallpaper of the ongoing felt sense of relatedness with this other being, this other fellow human animal, then things really change, don't they? Things just start really changing as we tune in increasingly to the ground of relatedness, this empathic, anukampa, you know, quivering in sympathy with others. And that's a wonderful thing. So when we touch that ground, we pull our attention back from all the flotsam and jetsam we're preoccupied with and reacting to and, frankly, chained to. We're unfree to the extent that we're identified with that flotsam and jetsam. We're caught up by it. We're enchanted by it in the Buddhist language. But if we can disenchant ourselves, in part aided by touching this ongoing ground to relatedness, we suffer less and we harm other people less too. You can really get a feeling of that, can't you? The other ground, briefly, and then see what you think, is the ground of awaring, of awareness, the ongoingness of consciousness. And that's the mindfulness practice that Ajahn Sucitto is talking about. And there, too, you might have noticed that you can really notice this when you're meditating or relatively quiet. Again, there too, in the stream of consciousness, there's content, right? You're thinking about something, you're worried about that, you're kind of fantasizing about something nice that'll happen later, just normal things. And then every so often, there's a kind of, and what's really present is the streaming itself. Or what's really present is a kind of awareness of the wallpaper of experience, this kind of background sensation in the body, and even the nature of the sensations, the nature of the thoughts, the kind of sense of them emerging and passing away, or the general sense of the familiarity of this experiencing, you know, distinct from the other person's experiencing, right? That's kind of the wallpaper. And that is a different kind of ground. It's a ground of minding, mind-ing, streaming. It keeps on going, doesn't it? Right? But increasingly, we can disengage from the particular contents. We can pay attention to what we need to pay attention to. But what starts coming forward more and more, and we start resting more and more in, is this ongoing relaxed sense of the streaming itself, with less and less caught upness in particular contents. We're aware of the contents, you know, but it's like being with the river. Mostly we're just chilling with the river. And we're getting a sense, this is river. It's rivering big time. And every so often, you know, a bloated cow floats by, right? Or a stick or a lovely orchid or something. But it's the rivering that really is what is the ground of our own experience. Meditation really helps us in deepening our sense of that because it's a practice in a way of disidentifying from content increasingly and being aware of more and more intimately how the mind chases content and identifies content and then reacts to content, which creates more content. But I invite you into, in a way, a practice that's becoming more and more real for me and important, which is to reach down increasingly into the ground of relating, you know, the ongoing field of anukampa, of empathizing, and the ground also of streaming, experiencing, you know, as the river itself. And I think on the, and that's where the two come together. In other words, as we are increasingly able to reach into that ground, to touch that earth, if you will, to touch that ground as the Buddha did, then we're also in an increasingly relaxed and authoritative way deal with what must be dealt with. I've seen abbots and senior teachers be quite authoritative when they need to be, and it's profoundly powerful. Because if I may use this word, which I'm generally not supposed to use in my role here, but because in a very healthy way, in my view, they don't give a damn. In a sense, that's what equanimity, in a very healthy sense of the word, is that. They're okay with that, you know, because they're touching the ground. They're so grounded in the streaming, and they're so grounded in relatedness, and they're so settled into their own fundamental kindness and compassion and ease that there's an enormous gravity, dignity, and potency when they need to deal with something. So. Okay, what do you think about this inquiry and this notion, especially for yourself, trying to help it become more real? What would it be like for me, you in other words, to reach more into this ground of empathy, relating, and also more relaxing into more seconds in your day into this ground of streaming, experiencing?
Okay. I was just going to say at the beginning, I didn't know how you were going to get those two together. So that letter was great.
Yeah.
It seemed to me when you started talking about it more and more clear that when you're authentic, then it's easier to not give a damn, as you say, and that you don't have to be as loud for people to respect you and to agree with you if you're coming from good intentions.
Thank you, that's right. And I want to be clear, obviously, on that phrase, which could be, misunderstood. Don't give a damn doesn't mean indifference or hostility or neglect, It means a kind of freedom. Yeah, great. Thank you. Anybody else? Yeah.
Now, I found that it helped me in a meditative kind of way when you said, rather than the particulars of the river, go to the Uber River, kind of book. And it translated very quickly into like a whole body experience as opposed to, any particular sensation that I was experiencing that was really solid.
That's great. I think that's a great pointing out instruction, awareness of the body as a whole. Great. Yeah, thank you. Really. Yeah. Great.
I think I will have to become a nun. Because being in this culture and being so conditioned, it's spoiled rotten about what you feel that you need, and the competition, and it's all part of me. And, to break out of that, that's a rock.
Well, two things about that. Actually, three. My kids say, what's your 4-point plan for this one, Dad? I tend to just, the best class I ever had in my entire life was in high school debate, where you had to think on your feet and, although maybe to a fault, but anyway. First, how brave of you to just kind of name that flat out. That's great. And I think that's incredibly important for us to do, to just kind of face squarely where we are, with including our reactive patterns and their...
I really wasn't finished because I wanted to say that I had the opportunity of going to another culture.
Yeah.
To going to San Miguel de Allende, Spanish, Mexico.
Yeah.
I was never so happy. And I was alone.
Yeah.
Because it's so familial and non-competitive.
Yeah.
And it was just a joy.
Yeah.
And so, and yet I love my country, and I love the achievements, but at the same time, it's like we've lost something. Or
Sure.
Or it's made it very hard for us to get back to the heart.
Yeah.
We used to have with family, you know.
I totally agree. And
that's what I mean. It's just, yeah. Makes you want to move, and at the same time, you know, you're stuck with wanting all this stuff.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that, and that also, you know, really resonates with the second thing I was thinking of, which is just the importance of practice. I mean, we're conditioned every day. You walk through a mall, you talk about materialistic, if you will, or Western culture, especially America, and life history, growing up in various conditions, you know, it changes the brain. And it takes practice to use plasticity of the brain, you know, to nudge it in a different direction. You know, there's no replacement. I think to myself, there's a direct relationship between shovelfuls of dirt and ditches dug, right? But here's the third thing, and this is something also I really wanted to put out here, and this is a kind of a recent insight that's made me really happy. It's this. If you notice in what Ajahn Sucitto is talking about, and it's very consistent with the Dharma broadly, Buddhist teachings broadly, he's basically saying that under or prior to, however you want to language it, more fundamental than the defilements and the ignorances is something really beautiful, is an ongoing natural empathic resonance with others, and a basic benevolence. And also, under the defilements and our ignorance is this ongoing kind of profound streaming of consciousness that's itself never harmed by what it represents. And they have a saying in Tibet, they talk about removing your obscurations to your original nature, your true nature. Okay? And related to that, there's a kind of controversy in Buddhism, especially academic Buddhism, about how much to think about a particular human individual, Siddhartha, Gautama, the Buddha himself, because the earliest surviving written record is about 4 or 5 centuries after his death, right? And a lot of stuff happened in between. So we have these teachings in the Pali Canon, these early records, which are books basically about Yewide. And then we have, of course, the Tibetan tradition, Chan, China, Chinese Buddhism, Zen, Pure Land, and now Western Buddhism. Wow, 2,500 years. Originating, I think, and many scholars do agree, with a particular individual. But fairly quickly it fanned out into what I call the Buddhist stream, historically. And we can never really exactly untangle what did the Buddha himself in particular say? What did someone else say? What did someone say the Buddha quoted later? What did the Buddha say that someone else modified? But these are people with profound attainments themselves, right? Whose voices have endured in the Buddhist stream that we are now being carried along by. That for me is a useful way to understand it. It's the Buddhist stream. It's a wisdom stream. And we get to see for ourselves what makes a difference for us in that streaming. But it's also true that there's a Buddha streaming inside each one of us. A Buddha upwelling, a Buddha wellspringing inside each of us. This natural quality of wakefulness streaming up, this quality of lovingness and relatedness and benevolence streaming up, you know, a sense that the obscurations, the ignorances, the defilements, whatever, are held in something pure that's helping them eventually dissipate. It reminds me of the teaching story that if you buy a house that's been boarded up for 30 years and you turn on the faucet and what comes out immediately is sludgy, smelly stuff, you want to shut the faucet down. But actually you need to let it run and remember that every single molecule of water is fundamentally pure. The defilements are held in the streaming, but the streaming itself is pure. That's a pretty cool way to have faith, particularly when we're beset by doubts, to have faith in this natural Buddha streaming inside each one of us, by whatever name we want to call it, this wakefulness, this movement toward wisdom, fundamental warm-heartedness, fundamental sensitivity and responsiveness to connection. That streaming is ongoing, whether we're aware of it or not. We're often not aware of it, right? We're caught up in content of one kind or another, especially reactive content of one kind or another. But that streaming is going on and on and on, and we can kind of lean back into it and open out into it increasingly and recognize it increasingly in other people. And that's a very cool thing to take refuge in. How about we end right there? Oh, I have 5 more minutes. I love it. Yeah. Comments or questions? Great.
You were talking about the history of the Buddha's teachings and how there's a 500-year gap before any written records were made.
Or survived. Maybe some were made, but you're right. You're right. A long time.
I heard an interesting discussion along that line of Christianity, which was that back in the early days of Christianity, people didn't care about the written record, facts that they could discover that had been recorded. They cared more about passing along the truth.
The stream. The Christ stream, the Buddha stream.
Yeah.
Great. Thank you. That's a lovely analogy. Thank you. Yeah. So it's very interesting to open to for yourself. Like, wow, how could I contact? To me, the practical question, if I could nominate one for you, is how could I give myself over to the Buddha stream inside myself? You know, which is a universal stream. It's not restricted to the Buddha. You know, that's a good question, isn't it? Okay, anyway. And your questions may not, or comments don't have to relate to that specifically. Yeah.
I noticed that as I meditate more, I'm able to contact that stream more when it's quiet, when it's calm. Sometimes you really have to go to places like work where you're walking into like a bunch of loaded cows.
Yep.
Every day.
All right. Working with my metaphor. I'm liking it.
To find the stream and then when you remember that there was a stream there.
Yeah.
But you lost it.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know it's there, but it's just trying to sort of wade away the cows to get there and it becomes impossible.
Oh, it's really hard. You know, just to kind of flag some keys, right, that are in the Dharma and, you know, I think they really work. One, of course, is to just notice that we're upset, you know, and to especially if we can have a second to breathe, even just to explore our own experience and just sort of be aware of our experience, which then starts drawing us right into the, I'm going to keep calling it this, but you can have your own term, the Buddha streaming, because we're suddenly aware that there's this ongoing process of consciousness that has content, and the content is impermanent. It's changing. It has a certain insubstantiality. That right there can help us be less upset. You know, one. Two, of course, is compassion for ourselves, to bring the heart into it. It's so deeply important. The heart in the body, the embodied heart, is so important, I think. And I'll just say one last thing, is to have the understanding of equanimity, where we start realizing that, oh my God, you know, this is such a mess. You know, there's so many things making this happen. There are 10,000 causes upstream of this moment of the river, right? Think of all the things that condition this channel and all those cows and the storms and their suffering and why they're doing what they're doing and my response to this and my childhood and my great-grandmother's mother and all of that just streaming through culture, you know, all that. Something about that also helps us kind of calm and do that. And then also, of course, take care of our own material interests. Maybe that means disengaging from consumer culture to some extent or preserving that one 2-week period a year where we leave the country, go to someplace really different, or go on retreat here and step out of the craziness just to have a real feeling for that. Great, okay. Yeah. But it's a real issue. I'm not trying to diminish it at all. But I love that metaphor of the faucet, you know, that the sludge, and I was releasing a certain amount of sludge, you know, every molecule of water is inherently pure.
Yeah. I'm just fascinated that I can't
Yeah.
Which is essential to having empathy and understanding.
Yeah.
If you can't even see one thing, not to see the person.
Yeah.
It's another thing to be texting and emailing all the time. It's like nobody's there. It's just words on a page. That doesn't mean anything.
Yeah. Thank you. I think you're right about, you know, culture and technology, especially for young people, creating distance and in a way numbing all that. And yet, you know, maybe I'll finish on this point. I grew up in West Covina, the armpit of Los Angeles. But anyway, in terms of smog, it was the center of the smog belt when I grew up. But still, basically it was tract homes laid on top of orange groves. Okay, so you can imagine dichondral lawns, sidewalks, planned communities, you know, middle class, lower middle class houses laid on top of orange groves. And yet, routinely, for decades after these houses were built, because I grew up in that environment, you would see orange trees poking back up through cracks in the sidewalk, certainly through in the lawn, you know. And there is something about that in our... The springs keep springing up, and things do smack them down. I'm not trying to minimize the, if you will, the unwholesome factors and forces. But there is something in us still, I think, that longs always to come home. And our true home is our ground, and our ground is in these streamings. And I have some hope for that. So how about we just sit and encourage you to... You know, can come out of the conceptual about all this, come out of the complications of it all, and do what works for you to contact your own natural Buddha streaming. In a way, we're talking about giving ourselves over to the ground or giving ourselves over to the streaming. What is it for each one of us to give ourselves over increasingly to the Buddha stream that is natural in each one of us? May you stream on with Linda next week, and I look forward to streaming with you in 2 weeks. Take care.